All right. This is the Legislative Ethics Committee, the full committee meeting. I'm Skip Cook, the chair. Welcome to everybody who is participating as a member of the committee and those who are participating at our request. It is May 17, 2018. It's 8.05 a.m. And Jackie, we're recording, all right? All right. Then we'll have Jerry take the roll.
Senator John Coghill.
Here. Good morning.
Senator Dennis Egan.
Good morning. Dennis Egan.
Representative Colleen Sullivan Leonard.
Here.
Representative Chris Tuck. Representative Chris Tuck not with us yet. Deborah Fancher.
Here.
Lee Holmes. Lee Holmes not present at this time. Joyce Anderson.
Here.
Connor Thomas.
Here.
Here.
With that, we have a quorum to conduct business.
And let's confirm on record who else is attending. I believe we have Dan Wayne from Legal. We have Skip Lobov from Personnel. And Senator Egan is on the phone. So, all right, that's those on the phone. We'll move to item two of the agenda, which is approval of the agenda. Are there any changes to today's agenda?
For approval.
To move that we approve the agenda. Any objections? Hearing none, the agenda is approved. And then we have five sets of minutes to be approved. We'll do those one at a time. The first one is the full committee is meeting on March 8th. Any objections? Hearing none, those are approved. We have the Senate subcommittee meeting of March 8th. Any objection? Hearing none, those are approved. The House subcommittee meeting of March 8th.
Move for approval.
Are there any objections? Hearing none, those are approved. We have the Senate subcommittee of April 21.
Move to approve.
Any objections? Hearing none, those are approved. And the House subcommittee of April 21.
Perfect.
Any objections? Hearing none, those are approved. We'll move to item four, public comment. Is there anyone who wishes to speak to the committee? There's no one here in the hearing room in Anchorage. Is there anyone else online who wishes to speak to the committee at this time? Hearing none, we'll move to item five, chair staff report. Jerry, do you want to give us a report on training?
I do have just a couple comments. First, with your additions to the packet, we have the budget fiscal year to date to May 8th. On that, one of our categories that we have shows that we are over budget, but we intend to have some of the contracts that we had lapse, and so some portions of that will lapse, and that we will not be actually over budget for the fiscal year due to the public hearing being continued until July. And so on that note, the date that we're looking at for that public hearing is July 17th. At this point in time, we would not have a Senate subcommittee meeting. That would be just the House subcommittee as part of that public hearing. This is related to a complaint to H-1703, Representative Eastman. We will have other things with the full committee we anticipate for that July 17th meeting. So if our Senate members have conflicts with that July 17th meeting, if they would just email me with any conflict that they might have. But that's the date that we're looking at for Both items.
And on that date, then we should probably schedule a full committee before the start of the hearing.
Right.
So, you know, perhaps the hearing at 10 and the full committee before that, so that it's not holding the button, and since we don't know how long the hearing lasts. Would a 8:30 start date be acceptable to everybody?
Yes.
If we had 8:30 till 10, or do we need to go to
8:30 would be enough for our full committee items. Senator Egan or Senator Coghill, do you have a conflict with that date of July 17th?
At this point, no for Coghill.
No for Egan.
All right.
This is Dan Wayne.
No conflict.
This is Dan Wayne. I may have a conflict on that date.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Well, if we start that date, let's then start at 8:30 and we'll do the meeting at 10 o'clock here.
The next item that I had for the full committee was the ethics training numbers. To date, we have conducted training for 548 legislators and legislative employees with the sexual harassment and other discrimination training. With our regular ethics training, 83 this calendar year to date. We have two new employees that just started here in May that have not completed that, but otherwise we're in full compliance with the training as required by the committee with the January meeting.
Good.
Then do you want to move on to the...
With that, we can move on to the...
To item six, are we going to discuss training for upcoming?
Yes, and I have provided in the packet for the members materials relating to our ethics training. As the members may recall, at our January meeting, the committee required the sexual harassment and other discrimination training for all legislators and legislative employees, but made it specifically only for this year. And so I've included in the packet what we do for, on the first page, what we do for new employees where we don't have a scheduled training. So we use basically just links, and the links that we're using are video links, and so new employees would take those that video training. And that is an alternative, but our regular training that we would conduct in January, of course, would be for all legislators and all legislative employees in January 2019. I've also included the sexual and other workplace harassment policy adopted by the Legislative Council and the Professional Workplace Conduct Policy, and then just some other items related to that. And why that was included was that to really get the committee's direction for training for next year, whether or not there should be that three-hour component that was required of all legislative boards and legislative employees this year, or in addition to the regular training, or what direction that committee thought we should take with the training. Because obviously, over the next few months, I'm going to be preparing that training for next year.
Right now, just sort of as a review, what we did. The Alaska Commission on Human Rights has been doing this training for legislative staff, for all staff.
And legislators. Yeah.
Oh, this last year they did for legislators, right.
In 2018, yes.
Right. Previously, they had done it for employees, but not legislators, right?
I think that there was a component on that with for both new employees and new legislators.
Okay. But not all legislators. Okay.
Not the full complement, just we did not have that for returning legislative staff or legislative employees. They did not get that that same 3-hour training.
Well, it was sort of been determined by the legislature is that that falls under our duties, and last year we used the training that's been done by the commission as the training for legislators. So now the question is, what do we do this next year? Do we do that again? And are they willing to do that? And or do we add that to our training, which is already 3 hours long? And then we would have essentially a 6-hour training block. We've got a 6-hour training block regardless, probably, unless we might be broken up by having them through the sexual harassment portion of it, are continuing to do what we're doing.
And we do have Skip Lobo online, and he may be able to address a little bit of the historical with regard to this training also.
Okay.
Chairman, could I have an Ed Yeast, please, for just one moment?
Sure. All right, thanks. We're back on. Yes, Skip Lobo, if you would correct any or verify anything that's been said about past training and sort of the current status, I'd be really appreciate that.
Absolutely, yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Skip Lobo, Human Resource Manager, Legislative Affairs Agency. Jerry is exactly correct. In the past, since 1996, new employees and legislators received '98 that I recall, right around in that area, but they received the EEO training for workplace, sexual and other workplace harassment, and we have done that each, we've done one session for each new employee orientation each year at the beginning, and it's usually coincided on the opposite day of the ethics training, so that we have a 3-hour block, then we have regular training, another 3-hour block for either ethics will go first or EEO, depending on people's schedules. So we have been doing that now for, that's over 20 years that I'm aware of. It may be longer, but that's I've been involved in the last 18 years of it, and I've seen the schedules 2 years prior.
Can I ask one question about that? Were they then only required to do that once as new employees, or were they required to repeat it at any point?
As new employees, they'd be required to repeat it. If maybe somebody was questioning it, they would be, let's say there was a complaint, or maybe somebody, not a complaint, but, you know, they were asked, hey, what is going on with this person? The rules chairs, if it's a staff employee, presiding officer, if it's a legislator, or any manager could say, hey, I want my staff to attend that. So there are people who attended it more regularly. Some people attended it because they do orientation every year anyway, because they always pick something up new there. But required, yes, only new employees or new legislators were required to go to it.
All right. And that, so that will be ongoing, as it had been in the past, by the commission, is that correct?
That is my understanding. That is correct. They usually do one training. This last time, I think we put on roughly 8 trainings, different time frames for EEO. So it was a more intense. In 2018, we had a more intense focus on getting training done. But my understanding is I will continue to at least work one training component into the new employee orientation and work with the executive director to do one new legislator portion of that, but I'm also here to help whatever way we can. If we want to work with EEOC to do maybe a larger push every 2 years, I'm happy to help you guys work through that as well.
Jerry, our training, remind us how our training works as far as who has to attend and how often.
All right. That training is repeated every 2 years, so this coming year in January would be the training that we would do for all legislators and legislative employees, and that would involve a number of different sessions. And the session for legislators is slightly shorter than the session for legislative employees that were not staffers. And the legislative staffers had the longest ethics training, and that would be 3 hours.
So our training to legislators is repeated
every 2 years.
Every 2 years. So I guess part of the question comes in then, if we were relying on the commission's training on the sexual harassment issues for everybody that's new, then do we need to do something every 2 years with regard to the legislators,
Well, statutorily, all legislative employees and legislative staffers and legislators by statute have to take that ethics training. And so this coming January would be that time when they would all take that training. And I guess the question I'm raising is, do we do our traditional 2 to 3 hour training, or do we try and incorporate the, in addition, the training that would be 3 hours as it was this year for the sexual harassment and discrimination training?
Mr. Chairman, this is Coghill.
Yes, Senator.
So, good morning. So, the Ledge Council had a group of legislators get together on the on a policy for workplace values, I think dealing especially with sexual assault and other things. And Skiff, maybe you can chime in on this, but they created a policy that they just passed out, a couple weeks ago. Was that anticipated, that would be a part of something they'd fill out, or is that something... I don't recall the answer to this, so that's why I'm asking. Was it something that was going to be brought in as part of our ethical training, or was it going to be something that would be part of our manual?
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, throughout that policy was to be part of the ethics training mandate, and I think what they're talking about on that is it is needs to be each 2 years or new employee, similar to the way you currently do ethics training. And they also indicated that violation of 1880 is a violation of the Ethics Act because, well, it's right in there, both the Ethics Act, and that therefore this is a component of ethics and needs to be treated as a component with ethics, not on a standalone the way it was. With that being said, it didn't say how it's going to be treated, and that would be up to working between us to figure out whether it will be a separate training or whether it will be a component of the ethics training. That's what I think Jerry is kind of trying to figure out at this point. But as for every 2 years, that's the way the policy was hooking it into the same statute, which it was already. It would just stand alone, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Sorry for taking so long to catch up with you, Mr. Chairman, but those two issues, even though they're tied together, are kind of very different. How long would it take, Skip, from your view, to review that? Would it take 20 minutes, half an hour?
Are we talking about, through the chair, Senator Coghill, are we talking about to perform a training or to do a quick overview of the policy?
My anticipation would be an overview of the policy because first you have to be aware of it, and I think that would be the first thing. And I don't know what more training would be involved in that. Maybe you have a better idea. I saw it, but I have not thought through it in terms of training.
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, a 20-minute to a half-hour overview of the policy and how that works would probably work in portion of the, if it's in conjunction with the ethics training. However, I'm not 100% sure if the Alaska State Commission on Human Rights would assume that as a full-fledged training program for employees. They usually say that would be like a couple hours at least would be my guess. But I would, that's from when I had talked with the trainer, Steve Kotef, at Alaska Commission on Human Rights.
So, Mr. Chairman, just one last comment. When we had the Human Rights Commission come before us, the questions actually derailed the PowerPoint that they had, at least the session I was in. And so there's a lot of questions that come up during that. Probably not a bad idea to have both a policy overview and that training as a separate item.
This is Skip Cook. And one question I might have is, if people are now going to be required to repeat that training every 2 years, whereas they haven't in the past, is it possible to have a, for those who are repeaters, a shorter, a more condensed version than the 3 hours? And might the commission be willing to take that on, and then we could continue with our training sort of the way it is? Or if they won't condense it, I guess one of our alternatives is just to have all those who are under our statute, our repeaters, attend that every time it's addressed.
This is Deb Fancher. What about having the repeat training online, face-to-face the first time? Now, the problem is, as you mentioned, Senator Coghill, you're not going to get some of those questions, but an online mandatory every two-year refresher is what they do in education for our repeat training. They do that regularly and routinely for the stuff that we have to go through as educators.
That's certainly another possibility. Jerry, have you had discussions with the folks at the commission on this?
I've not had any direct communications with them. As I started out with, we have had that video up for those, obviously, that came later and that were unable to attend one of the in-person ones. But that was a three-hour video. And, I mean, that for a, alternative, a shorter alternative could be a possibility. But I have not approached the commission about doing a shorter version that we could put online for everyone. But that certainly is an alternative rather than scheduling 8 trainings like we had this year.
Well, could I ask sort of Skip and Jerry at the same time, would could it be arranged for a meeting between Jerry and Skip and commission people to kind of take a look at this and be ready to report back on it perhaps next month when we meet again?
This is Skip, Chairman. Yes, I have no problem. I'm in contact with them now and then on various issues. I'll be more than happy to arrange a meeting where we can get back and we can find out what can be done. Something along the line of, and this is what I'm kind of hearing you guys are talking about a little bit, the new employees and legislators still, the full training, and then do a watered-down version for returning employees or employees that took it the previous time and have that maybe videoed so that it could be up for people who come in after the trainings have been done. Is that sounding like a direction I'm hearing correct?
I think that is correct. Just if those possibilities can be discussed and then if we could have an indication next time. We're going to be meeting a month from or 2 months in July. That's
17th is what we're looking at, Skip. If you're available that date for a full committee meeting, the next full committee meeting,
I will be out that week.
Well, as long as Jerry has the information and can come back, I'm more concerned about what happens between now and then as opposed to what happens.
And, and that's correct. I can get Jerry will have all the information. Actually, I may be able to teleconference into that as well if it's a teleconference available.
That'd be great.
Chairman, if I could just interject.
Sure.
Real quickly. I know, too, that Skip is real familiar with SHRM, the Society of Human Resource Management, and I'm a member of that, and they have incredible videos and all sorts of templates with regard to the sexual harassment EEOC training, and I know there's certainly something I think we could pull from that and have so that it's a good refresher piece that the state could use. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Anything else on that subject, Connor?
My one question I have is, in terms of what we need to do today, I mean, is it a foregone conclusion that the sexual harassment training is a responsibility of the Ethics Committee to put on?
The legislature seemed to think so last year, and there is wording in our statute that, Jerry, can you point us to that language again?
I think the excerpt that you got from the policy that's in your packet, it's the second page in to your packet, the excerpt from the Sexual and Other Workplace Harassment Policy adopted by Legislative Council on April 23rd, is what has been addressed by the legislature.
And where is it
in the packet? That
I mean, I see that part.
2460-155.
It's from the newly adopted policy by Reg Council. But our training under 155, AS 2460-155, is the actual statutory language that you'd want to look to.
Okay.
And that, let's just review what that says.
This is Dan Wayne. I have that. I could read it to you if you want.
Okay, yeah, go ahead, Dan. I've got it now, too, but go ahead and read it for us.
A person who is a legislator, legislative employee, or public member of the committee, an intern, or a legislative volunteer shall complete a legislative ethics course administered by the committee under 2460-158-4. Within 10 days of the first day of the first regular session of each legislature, and then the committee can give them extra time, and then there's also provision for people who come in after the session starts.
But isn't there some language that brings in the workplace harassment and so on?
Yeah, that's under, let's see. Give me 1 second.
I think it's 2460039.
039A prohibits legislators and legislative employees from engaging in, quote, acts of discrimination in violation of 1880-220. It doesn't mention anything about a legislative sexual harassment policy. So it kind of raises an issue about whether or not the training on the sexual harassment policy is mandatory. Under the Ethics Act. I mean, it isn't. Even though the policy says that it kind of says that it is, the Legislative Council doesn't get to amend the ethics statutes by itself. So that would take a change to statute. But that doesn't mean that the legislature can't sneak it in there and add it as part of their training, add it as part of the mandatory training. And it is very, the sexual harassment policy does have a lot of things in common with the Human Rights Act provisions that prohibit sexual harassment. So it's not a big deal. But if you were just going to have a standalone orientation or training about the sexual harassment policy, that's something that's not mandatory under the Legislative Ethics Act.
Danger again, if you remember when this came up to our group, this was brought up because I believe that it was the legislators that wanted to make something like this mandatory, and going through the Ethics Committee was the only way to make this training mandatory. There were people that didn't want to do it, that didn't want to do any sexual harassment training and had refused to do sexual harassment training. So it came to us, if we incorporated this into the ethics training, which was mandatory, then they would get all the training at one glump.
And if I could, this is Dan Wayne, and that's correct, and that training that was provided had to do with compliance with AS 1880-220A, which is the section of law that prohibits sexual harassment in the workplace. The legislature did, if the legislature amends the Ethics Act to add that training shall also be provided about the legislator's separate sexual harassment internal policy, then that could be, that training could be made mandatory as well. The other way, of course, it could just be grafted onto the training that you're already providing. It's similar, it's, you know, it's relevant, and so.
Through the chair, this is Skip, if I may.
Yes.
But when you look at violations of 1880-220, the policy, when we're talking about training, we're talking about training on 1880-220. The policy is how employees can go through, and if they have a violation, how they're supposed to act. So I would argue that the meat of the thing is in the ethics realm, where it talks about training, the meaning of compliance of AS 1880-220, which is in the Ethics Act under 2460.039. The policy is just a venue under EEOC regulations that a corporation is supposed to have. So they're not totally separate, because the policy is set up to address 1880. Ethics Act also addresses 1880. It's how you handle a situation that it comes from a complaint.
And I think that's all true, but the Ethics Committee might want to consider whether it wants to get involved in administering the sexual harassment policy adopted by the legislature or interpreting its provisions, especially the ones that don't have really anything to do with the Human Rights Act, that have to do with how the sexual harassment policy is administered and the procedural steps and so forth, which are all good things, important things for people to know. But the Ethics Committee didn't craft the policy, and it's not part of what the Ethics Committee does to administer that policy.
This is Senator Coghill, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator.
Last year, because of the extraordinary circumstances, we had several people that just needed to be dealt with. So I think that was one of the reasons why the mandate for that year, but the question came up, do we want to do that mandatorily every year? I don't know that that was totally answered. And part of it was because they wanted to go through a SCIF and make that that policy. So I tend to agree with Dan that the failure to act properly is something that may be under a complaint you can deal with and look at the policy. But then, you know, the pushback that I saw in the legislators was, you know, that the kind of the time of the training that was kind of an extraordinary event for the Ethics Committee. So I think the information should be given. I think it's valuable. I like a little bit of what the Human Rights Commission did, but it is a different venue than the ethics. And that's why I think they should be two. If they're going to be separate, I think they should be separate. Then it's just a matter of how long. And I think the suggestion on a review policy is probably the more important part, because the Ethics Committee will deal with breaches, that's for sure. But the for me as a long-term legislator, I can tell you, knowing those policies being reviewed, those kind of things are important. But first-time legislators need to know, when you are an employer and you live in this complex employer circumstance, they need to know what their responsibilities are. So the human rights issue and this is where Skip and I might even have some disagreement, I don't know, but I see that as a slightly different venue.
I guess one of the questions is, under 039, it says the legislator may not act in, or employee may not act in acts of discrimination. So does discrimination encompass all the types of discrimination under 18 and in sexual harassment discrimination? If it is, it can logically be seen to come under our venue, and I think that's a way to put it. So, but you know, maybe we should let that be worked out and just go ahead and see what we can work out about forms of training. But part of our concern was that if we're having legislators having to come to 6 hours of training every 2 years, that might get a bit onerous. If we can do some refresher training as an alternative to that, still using the tools that are already in place, that seems to me to be somewhat logical.
Well, I mean, I guess it seems to me one of the questions that we would have to face is, what are we actually talking about in terms of training that we're going to require people to do, assuming that we're going to do that? I mean, if we're going to do an overview, as Senator Coghill says, as part of our ethics training, which would be 25 or 30 minutes in addition to what we already do, that's one thing. But if we're going to say, and by the way, you've got to go to this other three-hour training that's put on by another group that's not our training, that's mandatory. I mean,
we would probably be looking at, if we were going to incorporate the sexual harassment training and all those issues into ours, we'd have to shorten up what we do already. Because we really, I think, we're not wanting our portion of training to get over 3 hours long.
So the way we possibly could leave this would be for Jerry to discuss with the Human Rights Commission what some sort of overview might look like and whether or not what the length of their training would be, which we kind of know is already 3 hours, right?
And that's for all new employees and new legislators. And the question is, what do we do for repeaters? And do we want to? We wouldn't have to do the law if we kept that in place, and that they're required to do it for all new legislators. Then we wouldn't want to be building that into our training for new legislators, because that's taken care of there. But the new legislators had to understand that they had to go to that training at our training, which is what happened this past year. So it's a little more concerned, I guess, with perhaps the repeat the second time around. Representative?
Chairman, I think, this is Colleen Sullivan-Leonard, but I think just to be in a position of knowing more instead of knowing less, I would agree with two training sessions for new employees or even returning employees. I mean, you'd be surprised after 2 years how people forget certain policies that are in place. And I think it's real important that we really continue that training aspect. We can certainly do a review process for those that are returning who have done this repeatedly. But, I have found just with my short time period here that there are those that have been around for a long time and they have forgotten things. And I would rather err on the side of caution and making sure that everybody knows the policy well so that we don't have a repeat of what happened in the 30th legislative session. Please know that was a very concerning time for me and other new legislators, and I just don't want to repeat reform.
All right. One possibility certainly is to simply leave the requirement in that they attend the training as given by the commission every 2 years. So let's let Jerry and Skip and the commission. Pardon, Senator Egan?
Yeah. I agree with Representative Sullivan-Leonard. I thought that training this year, early this year, was excellent. I think that everybody had to do it every 2 years, employees and legislators, because all the things that went on early in the session, it made a heck of a difference. I mean, it turned a lot of people around.
All right. Well, I appreciate those comments. And as part of the assignment to Jerry and Skip, then, one thing would be to find out if the commission then is willing to provide it every 2 years, which is an increase in what they've done in the past. But that would be one solution, would be just simply to ask them to take care of that portion of the training every 2 years. So maybe an alternative would be to have that available for those who could do it in person, to have it available online. But there is, as we've discussed, there's some benefit to the discussion that goes on at those trainings. So we can just have a report back in July.
Mr. Chair.
Great, thank you.
Going to do the sexual harassment training and so forth, is that going to be kept track of like it is for ethics training? I mean, that's a big component as well. So it's going to be a requirement, is that what we're saying? So that Jerry will keep track, or the office will keep track of who attended ethics training?
Yes.
Who attended the other training, and if not, follow up?
Yes, that would... We're required to keep track of that. So if we're utilizing that as a training moment, then we keep track. All right. Well, thank you. Let's move on, if I can find my agenda, which I buried, to advisory opinion 1802. We have Dan available. Jerry, do you have anything to say before we turn it to Dan?
I have no preliminary comments on that.
All right. Then, Dan, if we could ask you to review what you have adapted for 1802.
Okay. Let's see here. Okay. Turning to page one. I think you all have it. There were two questions. They're kind of similar. Can a legislator, after a state-funded relocation to Juneau for a legislative session, attend and sponsor a fundraiser for a state election campaign before the start of the legislative session? And may a legislator, after a state-funded relocation to Juneau for a session, attend a political forum or fundraising dinner for a political party in Juneau during that legislative session? And in the draft, it concludes that the legislator, after a state-funded relocation to Juneau for a legislative session, may attend and sponsor a fundraiser for a state election campaign before the start of the legislative session. And the body of the opinion talks about how that wouldn't be allowed at other times, but before the start of it, it's okay. And then... it answers the second question by saying that after a state-funded relocation to Juneau for a legislative session, they may attend a political forum or a fundraising dinner for a political party in Juneau during the session, as long as they merely attend and don't directly or indirectly host, co-host, solicit participation, promote the event, or aid in the fundraising. So it has to be pretty careful because... I think we saw an example some years ago of where people's names were being listed on flyers advertising these events, and the question came up, well, is just having my name on the poster, allowed? And I think the committee said no, or maybe it was just staff advised no, because you're promoting the event. So you have to be... really mind your P's and Q's, but if you did that, you could go to these things. That's all I have.
All right. Any other questions for Dan? Any corrections or changes to the opinion as drafted?
I would move that we adopt the advisory opinion 218-15.
All right. The Congress has moved that we adopt 1802 as drafted and presented. Any amendment they figure?
Mr. Chairman, this Senator Coghill.
Yes.
I've been frantically searching through my emails for that. I haven't seen the conclusion, so my apologies. I have not been able to get to that and read the conclusion on that particular opinion, 1802 or 3. 1802, I guess, had two questions. I'm sorry. Can you just reiterate the conclusion to me, please?
Yes. This is Dan Wayne, through the chair. It's short, so I'll just read it as it's written. It says, for the reasons stated above and based on the facts provided and the facts assumed for purposes of this opinion, the committee finds that, number one, a legislator after a state-funded relocation to Juneau for a legislative session may attend and sponsor a fundraiser for a state election campaign before the start of the legislative session. And number two, a legislator after a state-funded relocation to Juneau for a legislative session may attend a political forum or a fundraising dinner for a political party in Juneau during that legislative session as long as the legislator merely attends and does not directly or indirectly host, co-host, solicit participation, promote the event, or aid the fundraising.
Okay, thank you.
All right, anything further? Jerry, would you call the roll on that?
In accordance with our policy, I'm going to read just the formal statement on 1802. Formal advisory opinion AO 1802 advises whether a legislator may, after a state-funded relocation to Juneau for a legislative session, attend and sponsor a fundraiser for a state election campaign before the start of the legislative session, and whether a legislator after a state-funded relocation to Juneau for a legislative session may attend a political forum or fundraising dinner for a political party in Juneau during that legislative session as long as the legislator merely attends and does not directly or indirectly host, co-host, solicit participation, promote the event, or aid the fundraising. Roll call vote is to concur or not concur with the final advisory opinion AO 1802. A vote of yes will be a vote to concur with the final advisory opinion. A vote of no will be to not concur with the final advisory opinion. With that, taking a roll, Senator John Coghill.
Yes.
Senator Dennis Egan.
Yes.
Representative Colleen Sullivan Leonard.
Yes.
Representative Chris Tuck is not available. Member Skip Cook.
Yes.
Member Connor Thomas.
Yes.
Member Joyce Anderson.
Yes.
Member Deb Fancher.
Yes.
Member Lee Holmes. Member Lee Holmes not available. A vote of 7-0 to concur with the advisory opinion.
Thank you. All right, we'll move on to item 8 on our agenda, and that is discussion of House Bill 44. Jerry, I'll let you remind us what that does.
We have Dan Wayne also available, who was part of the drafting on this, and so I'm going to ask for his comments also with regard to this. It was included in the packet of the material. For the members, the HB 44 has a number of provisions on it, some that apply to the APOC provisions under AS 1513, but also sections that apply with the Legislative Ethics Act. And those are the ones that I'm going to focus on as part of the review here for the committee. The specific provisions that are in that bill, HB 44, that are looking at a change and a significant change for the Legislative Ethics Act, begin on page 8 of that bill. Under that particular bill, it does amend gift of food and drink or beverage for immediate consumption to a gift of food or a non-alcoholic beverage for immediate consumption to a person covered under AS 2460. And so, of course, it impacts our statute AS 2460-080-AQA. And so that is a change under the Ethics Act. In addition, Section 7 on page 8 amends our 030E. And this is a significant change because it expands the provisions under that 030 to what it was before was simply a person who was negotiating for employment would be restricted from taking official action, taking or withholding official action or exerting official influence that could substantially benefit or harm the financial interests of a person. It expands that to not only those situations where a person is negotiating for employment, but to also that person who is a member of a legislator's immediate family or a member of the immediate family who is employed by that person. Or in addition, it leaves in the provision with regard to the legislator who is negotiating for employment. And then under D on page 9 of that bill, from whom the legislator or member of the legislator's immediate family has in the immediately preceding 12-month period earned more than $10,000 worth of income. So I'm going to have Dan explain a little bit because he has worked with that provision about substantially benefit or harm the financial interest of another person or taking or withholding official action or exert official influence. And Dan, if you might chime in on what that would extend to.
You're asking me about
taking or withholding the official action or exert official influence?
Right. Remember the see. Well, it uses the word substantially, right? And it's substantially benefit or harm. And so that's kind of the yardstick. In that, the bill has a new definition to say what that is. It's on page 9. It says in this section, substantially benefit or harm means that the effect on the person's financial interest is greater than the effect on the financial interest of the general public of the state. So I'm not really sure how far that goes. I mean, I think it's just we're just going to have to see what kind of facts come before the committee to see. Up to that point, it's up to each individual to you know, figure out what it means, call the ethics office and ask Jerry for advice about whether or not they need to declare conflict and so forth. But it's pretty broad. So it's hard to describe exactly what it is. I think you have to just look at it on a case-by-case basis.
And for the committee, you may recall that we've had a number of advisory opinions under the old rule about when that would apply. And so I believe that there may be, again, an opportunity for the Ethics Committee to explore that with individual legislators if they ask for formal advice. And I would expect that under the changes that are made to this under HB 44, with regard to taking and withholding official action or exerting official influence, this would include, for example, as I understand that, to be things like introducing a bill, co-sponsoring a bill. I think that's a very broad definition of take or withhold official action or exert official influence. And that was where I was hoping that you might be able to help the committee with that term, Dan.
Well, there's no definition in the Legislative Ethics Act of official action, but there is a definition of legislative action. And I think in the past the committee has said that official action includes legislative action, but official action is the broader term. So I don't know, maybe if the committee looks at that again and is asked to write an opinion or, you know, venture an opinion, it may, you know, that could change, but I think that's kind of how it's been looked at before. And legislative action, as Jerry pointed out, means conduct relating to the development, drafting, consideration, sponsorship, enactment, or defeat, support or opposition to or of a law, amendment, resolution, report, nomination, or other matter affected by legislative action or inaction. So, you know, there's a lot of a lot of ways that this could go, depending on the facts in each situation.
Good question.
Yes, absolutely.
Thank you, through the chair. Mr. Wayne, so you assisted in drafting this particular legislation. Can you help us at least understand what the intent was from the maker of this particular legislation? This section 9, number 2,
section 9,
discussions
number
with that particular legislator?
Well, I can't talk about my discussions with the particular legislator or
basic intent?
I think that, you know, basic intent was, you know, talked about in hearings and so forth, but also there's a sponsor statement that discusses it, and I think I might be able to, let's see, thought I had that on screen earlier. Yeah, here it is. I mean, I don't necessarily want to read the whole thing, I guess, but it's part of it says HB 44 contains provisions to ensure that conflicts are substantial before a legislator would be required to abstain from voting. Any benefit a legislator or a member of the legislator's immediate family might receive from supporting a particular piece of legislation would have to be greater than the benefit a large group of Alaskans would receive in order to require abstention. The bill recognizes the responsibility of legislators to vote, et cetera. Let's see. Except in clear cases where the outcome of the vote would result in substantial personal financial gain. This includes cases where an immediate family member or a legislator's employer would receive a large and direct financial benefit. So, you know, from that, it doesn't look like the intent was to rule out every possible type of financial benefit. It has to be something big. But that's just the intent language in the sponsor statement. So,
Mr. Chairman, if I could do a follow-up question.
Sure.
Mr. Wayne, one of the challenges I have had on the House floor is to actually declare a conflict of interest based on a family member that works for a certain company where that particular legislation had tied in, and they would have financial gain based on the particular legislation. Every time I've declared that, though, the body objects, and therefore I have to vote on a particular bill before me. Will the legislation here in HB 44 then maybe better define the aspect of truly a legislator who does feel that there is a clear conflict, yet is objected to every time they try to abstain?
And this is Skip. I had a question that was very similar to that. With regard to Section 8, it says, unless otherwise required by the uniform rules,
now they have to declare a conflict both in committee and on the floor before voting. But what do the uniform rules, do they override that still, like the representative is saying, or will they actually have to declare and be excused if they have the conflict?
Through the chair, this is Dan Wayne. First of all, that's been a problem that a lot of people have had when they've tried to abstain. I think in virtually every case, there's been an objection and they've been required to vote in the last history. And that's because of the uniform rules. The bill doesn't change the uniform rules. And the uniform rules in this instance would trump the statute. So it's the same as it ever was in the sense that if on the floor when you're voting, you declare a conflict, same old rule still applies. That hasn't changed. But I think that the question is, if we go back and look at Section 7 of the bill, which talks about taking or withholding official action, which includes voting, but except that it's voting is dealt with separately, so it would only apply to stuff other than floor votes, committee votes, some other kind of legislative action. The bill takes out the unless required by the uniform rules of the Alaska State Legislature qualification. So it doesn't look like the rules trump this part of it. So for anything other than a floor vote, let's say you wanted to sponsor a bill where you had a conflict of interest, you would have to abstain. And there's no rule that was requiring you to sponsor the bill. And the same is probably true of voting in committee. But what it doesn't do, what 2460.030E doesn't do, it doesn't require somebody to declare a conflict in committee. So there's no declaration of conflict, objection, piece like there is in floor votes. It's just up to each person to decide whether or not they have a conflict and how to proceed. If they follow this rule, then they'll say, I'm abstaining from this vote, and they could say, I have a conflict of interest. I suppose that might be a good idea for them to make a record of that. But it is going to change the way things are done in committee if people follow this new law.
So in committee, they will have to declare, they do have to declare a conflict before the committee, and they can ask to be.
They don't have to declare a conflict. They just, this new law requires that they not take or withhold official action. That would include voting in a committee.
I mean, it says a legislator shall declare a conflict on a question before a committee of the legislature and shall request to be excused from voting.
Well, that's
a question before the House. So
that's in
a committee or on the floor.
You're right, it does. And I apologize. I've been working on a draft of this.
Yeah, no, it's more clear in the committee. But then again, the question is, do the uniform rules allow the committee to say you've got to vote in committee, or can the committee chair actually excuse somebody from voting? Do you have the uniform rule that bears upon this handy? None of us seem to have it here.
I do. Pretty handy. Let's see.
If you could read that uniform rule to us, it would probably be helpful. And then the question is, does it apply just on the floor, or are they required to vote on the floor or in committee also?
Well, the rule I'm thinking of, I think, is Rule 26, and it applies only that only applies to floor votes. Let's see here. No, that's not Rule 26, is it? Darn it. Uniform rules are not my
24 best choice says.
I'll find it here. It's Rule 34B.
34. Yeah.
Every member present in the House shall vote unless the House, for special reasons, permits a member to abstain. When it's talking about the House, it's talking about the Senate or the House of Representatives.
So the Senate, the House could allow them to abstain after declaration of conflict, but does not have to and traditionally has not. Is that kind of how it
well,
goes?
Well, traditionally how it's dealt with, if, because it has to be unanimous, if one person objects, then there's really no point in
right.
in going further. It's not going to be unanimous. The member may not be permitted to abstain except upon the unanimous consent of the membership. So, but Rule 34, I think, you know, honestly, I think there's been some debate about this in the past, whether it applies in committees or not, and I don't know how that's been resolved. It's really not an ethics question. It's a uniform rules question, and I'd probably want to talk with other lawyers here in my office about that before I give an opinion on the fly.
If Senator Coggio, maybe I could shed some light on that.
Yes,
see,
go ahead, Heather.
The reason why it's a question within the committee is because a bill generally and legally does not belong to the committee. It belongs to the whole body. And so the committees can vote to move a bill out of committee, but it's the recommendations that that are the final day, the opinion on that bill. The actual voting for that bill happens on the floor. And part of the problem that we've had to deal with is when a bill gets no votes to get it out of committee, that's usually when that question will come up. As you can see, the discharge from a committee can happen on the floor at any time. So the bill belongs to the whole body, and if they choose to bring that bill either to the next committee or to the floor, that's a majority vote. So that's one of the reasons why I think that question has come up on declaring a conflict in committee. People have done that generally, saying, this affects a business that I am involved in, but it's been required of people to at least be a part of the discussion because at the end of the day, they do not have a say on the final disposition of that bill until it's on the floor.
Right. Well, from an ethics committee standpoint, I guess the point where we would come in would be that we might get complaints that somebody did not declare the conflict, and they are required to declare it both in committee and on the floor. So as far as what happens to it after that, we don't have any control, but we might be called upon to address the question of whether somebody failed to declare a conflict than they had.
Here is one other comment. I know we're talking about immediate family, and I just wanted to point out that there's really two definitions of immediate family, and one that's being referred to here would be the actual definition in statute, which is narrow compared to the one in the gift statute, which includes, grandparents and aunts and uncles and so forth. So there's really two, so I didn't have important to find that the definition of immediate family is the more narrow one.
Sure.
2460-990, which is the definition section.
All right. Thanks, Joyce. Jerry, any other discussion on that section? If not, we'll go back to Jerry to see if there are other sections that we can look at.
Well, just a reminder for the committee, of course, historically you've had formal advisory opinion requests with regard to do I have a conflict of interest, and I anticipate getting those with this new legislation, and that was my whole point with my discussion of the bill. Yeah, there's points that are not particularly clear, but I think that the committee will be called upon to make those decisions in formal advisory committee requests, and just kind of a heads up that this is probably coming.
Yep.
And so it may not be in a complaint situation, but maybe in more of a formal advisory opinion request format.
And it did affect our training, too.
And it does affect our training. It substantially affects a number of sections in that training. So, of course, that will be incorporated into the new training.
And, Mr. Chair, the other thing I wanted to point out is there's a new definition in Section 11, which is financial interest. So that's been added as well. So Section 11 of the bill on page 10 on the bottom.
Wait,
we have a new definition of what financial.
Right. So, Mary, you'll take that into account in the training.
Yes. Yeah.
All right. Anything else with regard to that legislation, Jerry?
I have nothing further on that item.
All right, if there's nothing there, we can move on to other items. And we've sort of discussed the one we had next meeting under there and checking calendars. Have we done enough on that, Jerry?
Unless there's other information that needs to be brought out before that, the next meeting of the full committee would be on 17th.
All right. Is there any other business? For the full committee. If not, we have House subcommittee scheduled for 10 o'clock, so we would take a break, except for those who were involved in the House subcommittee would be need to be available at 10.
Adjourn.
All right. We move to adjourn the full committee meeting. Any objections? Hearing none, we'll adjourn full committee and we'll reconvene the House subcommittee at 10 o'clock. Thank you.